In some ways, we're going out of the armchair that economists tend to be in. Economists, have you heard the term an armchair philosopher? Ever heard it before? Or an armchair theorist? Somebody sits in an armchair, relaxing, and say, I wonder how such and such happens. I presume it happens this way. Hypothesizing about how people behave, for example, rather than going out and experimentally working out what people actually do. Now, really, that's been the nature of the economics you've been taught so far. It starts from somebody sitting in an armchair saying, how do we think a rational person behaves? Rather than going out and examining how people behave and saying, well, that must be rational behaviour in the majority because we expect most people to be sane and we wouldn't have built the society we have if we didn't actually do things intelligently. So that's the way economists go about it. I'm going to oppose that and say, let's actually look at how people behave in fact. What do they actually do when confronted with various choices, which we might call economic or financial choices? And then how do actual markets behave? Not how a hypothetical market in perfect equilibrium should behave in perfect competition, but how do actual markets behave? What do we find out of the data on finance markets and housing markets and so on? So in effect, I'm putting economics in the couch here because frankly, I regard economic theory as mainly mad. Their idea of what's rational, and I'll try to establish that for you by the end of this lecture, is extremely irrational. We need a different definition of what is rational behaviour. And ultimately, I'll get to this whole question of how did we get into the global financial crisis? Because when you take a look at the data before the crisis hit, the way macroeconomists described it was as a great moderation. What they saw was this process happening. The red line there is the inflation rate in America going back to 1970, and the blue line is the unemployment rate. And you can see how inflation got up to about 15% per annum in the 70s, and then it's been trending down quite dramatically, dramatic fall in the late 70s and early 80s, and heading down towards the 2 to 4% range, quite low. But as you can see at the end there, spiking up a bit. And the unemployment level also got to be quite high, reaching 11% back in the 80s, The American crisis in the 90s wasn't as bad as the Australian one, so they didn't have as high a level of unemployment. But you can see there's a trend for that level of unemployment to fall. 11%, 8% at the last crisis in 2004, 2003, about 6%. So they call that the Great Moderation. But then everything went very, very badly wrong. And they're now calling it, what's happening in America, they're calling the Great Recession. But this is what happened. Unemployment went sky high, and inflation went from rising a bit, and about 3%, down to minus 2, and then turned around, but it's now heading back down again. The last two inflation, monthly inflation figures in America were negative. So there's something very strange happening in the global economy. What we'll do on this subject, by the end of it, is build a model that generates exactly those characteristics, and this is what the model looks like. Everything seems to be getting stable and all of a sudden unemployment goes through the roof and the inflation rates go strongly negative. So it's possible to model the sort of behaviour I've seen in the macroeconomy, but you can't do it for the sort of economics you've been taught so far. So I've got to teach you a different approach to economics. Now, the a priori notions you've been taught about behaviour in micro so far are that consumers maximise utility subject to a budget constraint. Remember all that stuff? Indifference curves? Budget constraints, okay. Does that sound a reasonable description of how people behave? Do you think you maximise your utility? Okay. And firms maximise profits subject to demand. Does that sound reasonable? We treat firms generally as being profit maximisers. Okay. And markets converge to an equilibrium. That sound fair enough? Tend towards it even if they don't get there? What do you think? Okay. In macro, we have the idea in macroeconomics is that agents have what they call rational expectations. Does that sound fair enough? Expectations are formed in a rational manner.
No.
What do you reckon then? Not rational?
Okay, I can't say that not rational because there are lots of different ideas in the economy.
Yeah.
So not every each of them can be rational because they conflict with each other. So we cannot go basically.
So you're saying the fact that there's divergence of views, I mean, you can't typecast the overall thing as being rational. I think that's a pretty valid starting point. In fact, what economists do is they say people are rational, and if they're rational, they use the economic model to predict the future accurately. I think that's pretty mad, frankly. But that's how economists talk about rational expectations. They don't actually talk about the heterogeneity you're talking about there. They imagine as if there's a single type of agent in the economy that makes decisions in the same way. So it's very different. But that your perspective of this divergence of views is closer to the way that I'll be talking in this subject. And then they say the economy, if all the agents actually make their expectations by using the economic theory to predict the future, then the economy will supposedly be in equilibrium. Then you have in finance the idea that if investors maximise their expected returns given the opportunities they face for investment. That's the basis of the capital assets pricing model. Sound reasonable? The conclusion of that model is that asset prices accurately reflect the future cash flows of all investments. Do you reckon that sounds right? You couldn't believe it today, could you? Maybe 4 years ago you might have believed it, but certainly not now. Now, that's the way economists have treated the concept of rationality. But if you take a look at other disciplines like psychology, biology, a whole range of other ones that consider behaviour, they analyse what actually happens. So they actually talk about whether a lion's pack is rational. They watch how the lions behave as hunters. They don't hypothesise what a rational lion would do. And they build theories of the mind that then replicate what they see happening in that actual behaviour. So they reverse the process. In fact, economists actually haven't done much experimental work at all. They've devised these theories about how people should behave without actually experimenting and seeing how they do behave until the subject of behavioural finance and behavioural economics came along. Now, those disciplines don't tag behaviour as rational or irrational before the event. And when you actually then have economists doing experiments and seeing how people actually behave given economic choices, what they find is that most people's behaviour doesn't fit what economists call rational. Which means there's two possibilities. Either everybody's irrational, or the way economists have defined the word rational itself is wrong. I'm going to be leaning in the second direction, and I'll show you why in this lecture. But let's just go through some of the standard stuff first of all, the standard theory of demand. So I'm taking you back to remind you of the micro you've done so far. So we're going to see where we go from here. So neoclassical microeconomic theory starts with the idea of utility maximising consumers. And the belief is that you're all rational and your objective is to maximise your utility given what the money you earn and the cost of buying commodities. Sound okay? That would then mean, according to the person who first developed this theory, that you obey the following set of rules. And I want to go each through them and see whether you think they sound reasonable or not. They're called the axioms of revealed preference. And the guy who invented them was an American economist, Paul Samuelson, one of the select group of people who won the Nobel Prize for Economics, doing this back in the 1930s. The first axiom he had was completeness. And imagine you're going shopping now, and you've got two shopping trolleys that have been randomly filled with goods from the supermarket. One's trolley A, the other's trolley B. Well, the argument that Samuelson said is, given any two baskets of commodities, any two shopping trolleys, you can decide whether you prefer shopping trolley A to B, or B to A, or you couldn't care which one you're given. So it's saying giving any two, you can make that choice. That sounds sensible? Okay, that's completeness. Transitivity is the next stage, and that's to say that if you prefer shopping trolley A to B, and then you separately prefer shopping trolley B to C, then you must prefer A to C. That sound reasonable? Again? Then there's non-satiation. This is getting slightly more complicated. More is preferred to less. So if you have shopping trolley A, and I throw in another bag of chips into shopping trolley A to make shopping trolley B, you necessarily prefer B to A. Sound fair enough? More is better than less?
Yes, I don't think so, again, because it is there are lots of things that need to prefer more or less. For example, I don't have enough room in my fridge to put
stuff. I might give you a piece of smoked salmon, which is going to go off if you can't put it in the fridge. There's no room in the fridge. So, there's a reason to challenge that particular one. This next one is slightly more complicated, and that's the idea of marginal utility. It's expressed in a more complicated way in Samuelson's original paper. But the basic idea is that each additional unit you get of something gives you less satisfaction than the unit you had before, but still gives you positive satisfaction. So if you have a bag of chips and you've got the first chip you eat out of the bag gives you more satisfaction than the last chip. That sound reasonable? Okay. Putting those together, you then get the idea of indifference curves coming out of it. Because it's then supposed to be possible to say, well, here's a range of choices I can give you between a number of biscuits and a number of bananas. And I choose silly elements for the axes because I believe the theory is silly, but I'll get there later. So bananas and biscuits sort of appeal to me as a silly combination of things to go shopping for. But the argument goes that using those propositions, you can derive these things we call indifference curves, where any point on any curve, you don't really care which point you get. If you're on the bottom curve here, W, you don't worry about whether you get lots of biscuits and very few bananas, or lots of bananas and very few biscuits. You're indifferent between the two, therefore they call it an indifference curve. So if I choose, say, point B and point A on that curve, B with lots of biscuits and A with lots of bananas, if those were the two shopping trolleys you faced, you wouldn't know which one to choose. Give me either one. Now, then if you have on a higher curve, it means that you necessarily prefer anything, any position on that higher curve to anything on a lower curve. So there's Z1, Z2, there's Y1, Y2. And notice with Z1, you get just as many biscuits, just as many bananas and more biscuits. So obviously you're going to prefer, because you're going to get more biscuits for it. But Z, as you notice, it lies on a higher curve, it involves less bananas. So it's arguing that the utility you lose by losing some of the bananas is more than compensated by the utility you gain by getting more biscuits. Fair enough? Okay. And more is always better, so there's point P, then any point in the Q area is better than P. That's the basic set of arguments. Now, when Samuelson put that argument together, and this is one of the readings you might get to read, he got the objection back from some critics that you can't observe indifference curves. You've just invented a way of thinking about how people behave that involves something that doesn't exist. But you've obviously all got neurons, otherwise you'd be dead, let alone not even this room. But you don't, indifference curves are a way of representing what your neurons are doing. You don't actually have a bunch of indifference curves you consult when you go shopping. So they're non-observable. And the argument was you shouldn't base science on things you can't observe. That's one of the main arguments Karl Popper made about the nature of science. There has to be something observable. He downplayed the importance of observation compared to conjecture, but nonetheless that was important. So Samuelson's solution to say, well, actually, even though we can't observe indifference curves, we can infer them using what he called revealed preference. That's where those axioms come from. And that is, you actually look at what you do and then say, how can we interpret what you do in terms of indifference curves? So the simplest instance is the idea that more is preferred to less. Well, we let you go shopping, and if you choose combination A, you must prefer, to be rational, you must prefer any combination in the square above A. Because there's more of everything else above the point A than there is in the point A itself. Now, what about if you can afford A and B? So your budget lets you buy both A and B, and you buy A. Well, that's only possible as A is on a higher indifference curve. So if you have a point B, and you can afford it with your budget, and you don't buy it, that means that A must be on a higher curve. And ditto for C. So you start drawing curves like that through the points you actually consume, and then you've got the indifference curves that Samuelson believed in. So there's A on a higher curve than B. With the budget, you can afford to buy either A or B. Therefore, the curve itself must be tangential at A and above B. B gives you less satisfaction, even though it's got more bananas in it. And then from that, you've got the entire map. So you say, well, here's the indifference curves. We've worked them out now. Now you want to work out what you're going to do when you go shopping. What price, how many units will you buy of bananas, given the prices you're confronted with? So you then take a range of different prices for bananas and say, well, with a very high price for bananas, which is the first curve, you can only afford to buy a small number. That's the number of bananas you buy, given this income. But that point in the vertical axis tells you what your income is. So I then drop down from there and say, well, there are three price levels and three quantities you consume. So I drop the quantities down. I then map what the prices were across there. And I've now got a demand curve. Okay, so that's how you derive a demand curve for an individual. Now, I'm emphasizing it's for an individual. And the law of demand is, as it's called, that consumption will rise as the price falls. But economists say there's a problem with this because there's some goods that can be so undesirable that consumption will fall rather than rise as the price falls. If some things get cheaper, you'll consume less of them. Now, you know what that's actually called, that particular effect? Anybody remember? You would have been taken through this ad nauseum in probably second year micro. Okay. The example they give is called the Giffen good. Have you heard of that one? Named after a guy called Rodney Giffen. The idea is that if you have if something drops in price and it's really undesirable, like for example, offal. You know what offal is? Intestines and stuff like that, that really lousy meat. Okay. As it gets cheaper, let's say if you're really, really poor and you've got to buy it, then you buy it. But if offal gets cheaper, so you can actually buy what you need for nutrients more cheaply, you might buy less offal and more of something nice. Like some actual, if you're a vegetarian, now vegetarians won't even be in the example here, but you might buy another form of meat that's actually tastier than offal. So the idea is that as the price of that really undesirable thing gets cheaper, it means you can afford more of everything, including it. But you like it so, you dislike it so much, you buy less of it when its price gets cheaper and more of other things because you free up some of your income. So that's what's called the income effect, and that can overwhelm the substitution effect. So the solution economists dreamt up, this is an English economist called John Hicks, developed what he called Hicksian compensated demand curves. Have you heard that one before? That's exactly what I want to see happen. You're allowed to yawn at this stage. It is boring. Okay. The idea being that what you say is, well, the actual indifference curve you can reach, the best one you can reach, actually gives you your psychic level of utility. If you actually choose the point of tangency between your budget and the highest indifference curve you can reach, that indifference curve tells you how well off you really are, because anywhere along that curve, you're equally happy. Okay. So what this says is, well, if the price falls, so you can actually afford to consume more, then you move out an indifference curve. Let's bring you back to that other indifference curve by shifting the new price line back so it's parallel and just touches the point of tangency, then that shows you, that compensates for the income effect. But the idea goes like this. You have an initial budget line, AA, and you find that on that indifference line, the consumer will choose bundle A, a shopping trolley bundle A, and that's on indifference curve X. And then you have a new relative price, which is cheaper, and the consumer chooses combination B that lies on a higher curve, which is Y. What you then do is you move that budget line back until it's tangential to X again, and then you'll necessarily show the consumer will be consuming more bananas. They move down the indifference curve. And so you get the fact that dropping the price while compensating for the income effect does mean you consume the same, a larger amount at the cheaper price, so the law of demand is consumed. And this is when people start doing what my mate in the front row just here did a moment ago. And I don't blame you in the least. It's boring. Yes, it is. but I'm going to get interesting beyond this point in a short while. Now, the next step up, that's just derived the demand curve for a single individual. So how do you derive demand curve for the whole, everybody who's shopping for bananas? How do you work out the overall demand curve for the market for bananas? What do you do next? Would be nice if that were true, but you can't do it. And I'm going to show you why in a moment. That's what you're shown in all the textbooks. Now that is fallacious. The simplest word for this is, intellectually, this is a lie. The textbooks gloss over it and simply assume you can do it in one go, and I'm sure your lecturer did the same thing. Take a look in the micro textbook to see if you can see any discussion of are there any problems in going from a single consumer's demand curve to the entire market demand curve. Now, I talk about it in more detail in the next lecture, but there are huge problems in doing that. In fact, they invalidate the whole idea of a market demand curve. And to me, it's one of the travesties of economics that economists haven't admitted this and moved on. Well, I'll go back to the theory of the individual consumer for the meantime now. So that's a warning about what I'll be talking about next week. So how does the theory stack up in reality? Well, it's arguing you can infer people's behaviour from observing what they do. And much to my amazement, a number of people tried to test this out. Now, the best test was done by a German academic called Sippel in 1997. It's published in the Economic Journal, so it's quite a leading piece of research. Most economists don't even know this research was done. And he did a very, very careful experiment. And my theory about it, I must actually meet him one of these days and find out whether I'm right. But I think what happened was he believed his theory worked, but he wanted to make it more lively for his students. So he had a small tutorial class with 12 students in it, and he got them into an experiment to actually confirm that this theory did work. Before he did that, there were a number of other papers that attempted to also confirm the theory, but they were much sloppier than Sippel's work. So one of them, there's these several I mentioned here, they did surveys of people's expenditure over time to work out whether their expenditure over time coincided with the theory of indifference curves. Can you see a problem with that? What could happen with a survey? Asking you what you bought in March and then asking you what you bought in April and May and June and July, what would happen? You might get really sick of offal. Okay? You might decide you like something else. You might become a vegetarian. Okay? Your preferences can change over time. Even though the theory doesn't talk about that, it's obvious over time that things will change in your own taste. So rather than picking up people's demands in that sense that Samuelson had it, you might be picking up people's tastes change over time. You get older. You suddenly don't like what you like when you're younger. That can happen too. And my favourite was to test out whether consumers are rational. Some bunch of experiment researchers surveyed people's behaviour in a psychiatric hospital. That takes my breath away. You don't go to a psychiatric hospital because you're sane, okay? Or regarded as sane. There's something wrong with you. But what they did in this experiment was they got the right at a particular psychiatric hospital to run the kiosk with artificial money. And they gave the inmates different amounts of money and they changed the prices around to test and see whether the purchases the inmates made from this kiosk fitted the theory of rational behaviour or not. And even funnier than that, somebody decided to test how many presses a rat would do of a bar to work out whether the rat's presses of a bar to get seeds and pellets and stuff was rational. That's pretty low-grade stuff. I don't worry about any of those papers. Sippel, on the other hand, was a lot more careful than that. For a start, he used students, university students. Now, you can say a lot of things about the university students, but you've got to at least accept they should be pretty sane. And he gave them a set of choices involving a budget constraint and a set of 8 commodities from which they could choose. And in the experiment, they got all the time they wanted to choose the goods, and at the end of it, they got to consume one of the bundles they chose. So here's the goods. There's a video clip. Watch a video clip for a while. Computer game, read a magazine, some drink, and some candy. All the sort of stuff you actually might, you know, be knocking off as a student. And you actually paid to go and do the experiment and then make the choices. And when it was over, you got to consume one of the bundles you chose. Okay. And you had unlimited time to choose the bundle you preferred. And most students took about 30 or so minutes to make each choice. And you repeated it 10 times. Each time there's a different income and a different set of relative prices to try to work out what you do. And after doing that 10 times, at random, one of the 10 bundles would be chosen. And you'd say, here you go, that's what you chose, go and consume them now in the next hour. So you go sit and watch a video game, watch a video clip, play a game, drink some Coke, eat some pretzels and chips and stuff like that. And he said the students clearly were doing it seriously, so they were definitely trying to find a combination that they would most enjoy consuming in that hour after the experiment. And they spent up to 30 to 40 minutes correcting their entries in some cases. I don't want, 1 litre of Coke, I'll take 0.5 litre. That sort of thing. And the propositions he were testing go by a set of names. What they call the weak axiom of revealed preference, or warp, is that if you prefer A to B, then you'll never prefer B to A. That's the shopping trolley case. You've got shopping trolley A, you choose A when you've got a choice of A or B. You should always choose A when you're given that choice again. And they're both affordable. The strong axiom is if you prefer A to B and B to C, then when you're given a choice between A and C, you should always choose A. Okay? So again, the stuff I've taken you through a while ago. That's the formal definition of somebody who's utility maximising. There's a weirder one called the generalised axiom, and that's calculating something about the costs involved if you're making a particular choice. So it's involving a price that applied when you made the combination to say if you chose a less desirable bundle, then it must have been substantially cheaper than the more desirable bundle at the time. So that one is slightly more complicated. And because of the results, I won't bother explaining it too carefully because it fell over. But here's the idea. There's an initial budget line, and you choose A when you can also afford to choose B. They're both on the budget line. Then A has to lie on a higher curve. It's basically, that's the basic notion behind the generalised axiom. So you should always prefer A to B in that situation. And if you have another budget where you can afford them both again, then you should still choose A. Even though it's cheaper to choose B, these now lies within your budget line, you should still choose A, but that's on a higher indifference curve. That's the idea of the generalised axiom. Now instead, what happened was students would actually choose B rather than A. So something was going wrong. And these were the results of those first experiments with those 12 students that Sipple thought he'd actually bring the theory alive by having them work out their own indifference curves. 11 of the 12 students violated the strong and the weak axiom. And 5 out of 12 violated the weaker one of the generalised axiom, which has got a bit more play in it. So Sipple was pretty stunned by that. All of a sudden he's finding he's got either a class full of insane people, or there's something wrong with the theory. So he repeated the experiment, this time with more students, 30. And he got worse results. The smaller number violated SARP and WARP, but even more, proportionately, violated GARP. So he found he expected to confirm the theory and bring it alive for the students and show how it worked, but he got a really, really bad pattern of violations. In the first experiment, 91.7%, 11 out of 12, were inconsistent with the strong axiom. In the second, 3/4 were inconsistent. So either he has to say his students are irrational, and if that's true, we'd need a theory of economics based on irrational behaviour. Or there's something wrong with the theory. We might take about a 10-minute break, and I'll come to him back and tell you what that was. See you in about 10 minutes' time. Let's get back to the lecture. So that's the table of a number of violations there. It's really mainly just, you don't need to learn the table, obviously, and all the stuff I've given you on WARP and SARP and GARP so far. They may turn up into question, possibly, though, but this stuff is just for your background. It's all in the paper itself, which is one of the readings some of you will get. So Sipple had to interpret those really weird results. He tried to confirm the neoclassical theory of utility maximising behaviour, and really what he'd done is contradict the theory. It hadn't worked. So there's a big problem. How do you cope with the fact that you've got a theory, you test it, and the theory doesn't work, it fails? What do you do next? Well, his first reaction was pretty mild, and say it wasn't particularly favourable. I think that's an understatement. But then he said, well, there's only a low number of inconsistencies. He said most students had an inconsistency of, say, 2, or the median was 2 inconsistencies out of 45, but the average is a lot higher. And he couldn't explain it by saying they weren't really motivated because he said they really were trying to work out the combination that gave them the most satisfaction. So how serious were the violations? Well, this is where Sipple's paper went from just being an interesting study to quite a serious piece of work. Because he said, let's try to quantify just how inconsistent these choices were with rational behaviour. And he used an index of the amount of income being wasted from inconsistent choices. When you chose A and you normally preferred A to B and then you chose B instead, when they were both affordable, if A actually gave you a high level of satisfaction, you had to be wasting some of your income to buy B instead. You could have spent it more sensibly by buying B. So use what's called the Afriat index, after the guy who invented the idea, and that's that you weight by some number the amount of money you spent buying bundle A when you could have bought B. You'd say if you choose A when B is affordable, then you say A must be preferred to B if this index times the price you paid for A is greater than the price you paid for B, combination B. And you'd say, let's say you prefer A over B if it's 11% more expensive to buy A and you still buy A. Then we say you prefer it. But if it needs a large gap in the cost of buying it, and when you choose it, to say, well, you actually do prefer A to B. And the basic way to think about this is like having thicker indifference curves. It's hard to get the logic of the numerical example, but the indifference curve illustration I think will make it obvious to you. Because if you have thick indifference curves, then there'll be more combinations that are shown as being the same as other combinations. So if you have the typical way economists draw these things, very, very thin indifference curves, then in that particular case, if E is equal to 1, and you have A and B and C, all of which cost much the same amount of money and are fairly similar numbers of quantities, you can say C is preferred to B and B is preferred to A. Okay? But if you say, let's say you put E equal to 0.95, then because B and C are very close together, that indifference curve covers both of them. And you can say, okay, you definitely prefer C to A or B, but you can no longer say that the person prefers A to B. That's the idea of using this R-Fiat index of E less than 1 to work out what bundle you choose. So in that particular case, if you chose A in one situation and B in the other, you'd no longer be called irrational. You wouldn't be violating the weak axiom anymore. Okay? With the value of E. So the smaller the number E is, the less choices are going to appear to be irrational given the theory. And the good news is that when you use the R-Fiat index of, say, of 0.99, then the number of violations dropped quite substantially. So it didn't make things look better. The bad news was that after a while, even for a very small value of that, the change in the value of the index, even making a random choice appeared rational. Literally just throwing darts and saying, I'll take that combination, thanks, appeared like rational behaviour once E was past 0.95. So there's something seriously wrong with the theory. If you rescue it to say that people are rational if they throw a dart at the dartboard to decide what to consume. Okay, that's not utility maximising, that's random choice. So E to point, and even worse, once you get down to a value of E to 0.9, random choice appeared more rational. There were less violations of throwing a rational behaviour out of what a dart did, a dartboard, than out of what the students themselves did. So there's something seriously wrong going on there. This is what Sipple did when he reused this re-weighting of 1, 0.99, 0.95 and 0.9 for the value of E. And in the first case, when you had the original weighting, so you had a very thin indifference curve, in other words, you still had that violation, 41.7% violated experiment 1, 63 in the second, and then looking at random choice, that's the next set, with random choice, 61.3% of the choices were violated the axiom, and 97%, you know, every last choice virtually violated the axioms of revealed preference for a random choice. But then with a value of 0.99, two-thirds of the random choices appeared irrational, the one-third appeared rational. With a value of 0.95, 7 out of 8 choices by a random selection looked like rational behaviour. So it didn't help at all. And when you got down to 0.9, there were less violations of the axioms from random choice than there were from what the students chose themselves. So it's a pretty bad outcome. Rather than rescuing the theory, he showed just how weak the theory appeared to be. And he made several other attempts to interpret the results, worth reading the paper to find out what they were. But his overall judgment was that the support for the hypothesis that people maximise their utility is at best mixed. And that's again being pretty mild about it. He said there were some subjects who appeared to be behaving according to the theory, but the majority did not. So therefore you're suddenly arguing the majority of people are irrational. Well, there's something very badly wrong with that. And he said, really, what we have to challenge is the whole idea that people maximise their utility. This is a serious piece of research you people should have learned about in your micro course, but these things don't happen. So we've now got a dilemma. If people aren't maximising utility, what are they actually doing? because you're clearly not going in to minimize your utility. What else is happening? Now, you're not being irrational. Okay, you'd be out there choosing food you couldn't stand for lunch. What makes me most miserable? I'll buy that. That's not what you do. Okay, you're not being irrational. There's something else you're doing. And it's actually the definition of rational behavior that economists use is irrational. There's something seriously flawed with that definition. So let's look through the assumptions again. You're supposed to obey these rules: completeness, transitivity, non-satiation, and convexity. Let's look at completeness. That's saying, given any two bundles of commodities, A and B, two shopping trolleys, you'll be able to decide whether you prefer A to B, B to A, or you can't make your mind up between the two. Now, that looks quite easy on the sort of diagrams and drawings, and really all you've been seeing in economics so far is drawings on a textbook. Because each bundle has just got two items in it, biscuits and bananas. You know, when's the last time you went shopping and walked out of a supermarket with only two commodities in your basket? Okay. Now, in that case, each bundle is just going to contain a certain number of those two items, say one biscuit and four bananas, or four biscuits and one banana, something like that. Let's say it's up to 10. You could buy up to 10 bananas and 10 biscuits, let's say. Well, how many combinations are you looking at? Well, in that case, we're now putting some numbers on those axes, and I think this will probably be the first time you've ever seen numbers turn up on a indifference curve. Take a look in your micro textbook and see if you can see numbers anywhere. Now, there's the combination you actually choose, given the theory, but there's 10, anywhere between 0 and 10 biscuits and 0 and 10 bananas. So those are all the combinations you could choose. So how many combinations are there? 100. 10 times 10. Actually, 121. I've got 9 going there because that gives you 0 as a choice. Okay. There's 100 combinations. Now, some you ignore because looking at them, it's quite obvious they're well outside your budget. Okay. But there are others that are too close to the budget line. You've got to look at them. So you don't need to consider all the choices, but there's about 10 there you have to consider. That means you've got 10 pairs of numbers of biscuits and bananas to look at, and 10 budget sums to work out whether they're inside or outside your budget constraint, and therefore 10 comparisons of utility to work out which of those you prefer looks pretty easy. Okay. What about when you've got to consider something else, like, for example, ice cream? How do you include ice cream on that graph? What do you do? You've got to draw another axis, haven't you? Okay, it's got to go to three dimensions. So let's just take a look. Say if you have two commodities, there's 100 combinations when there's between 0 and 9 units of each being purchased. When you add in a third, there's 1,000 combinations. When you add in a fourth, there's 10,000 combinations. And you keep on going, you get a rather large number of combinations to consider. Let's look at Sybil's experiment now and see what's going on there. There were 8 commodities, okay? So you needed 8 dimensions to represent the choices students were making. Now, let's make it easy. Let's just make it even easier for the students than it was in Sybil's experiment. I'm going to discretize it and say the students were told you had to choose either 0, 15, 30, 45, or 60 minutes of video. You couldn't choose 33 minutes. In fact, you let them choose 33 minutes, that sort of thing. But let's say only those 5 combinations. That means there's 5 bundles you can choose: 0, 15, 30, 40, or 60, 45, or 60. The same, you know, 400, no Coke, 500, 1,000, 1.5, 2 litres, etc. 5 combinations of everything. That means there's 5 different combinations for each of the 8 commodities. So you have 5 times 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 5 bundles to look at. How many bundles is that? A lot. That's pretty close. 390,000. So in other words, if I actually wanted to fill up shopping trolleys with all these various combinations in it, we'd have 390,000 shopping trolleys to look at. Do you reckon you can decide which one you prefer? Yeah. Absolutely. It's just too big. We'd cover it'd be fun to try one of these days. I might try with Google Maps, see how many shopping trolleys I can put on Parramatta campus. Just to make that comparison, you've got to be able to look across literally virtually half a million shopping trolleys. So the reality is, You can't decide. You can't have complete preferences. The theory falls over at the very first step of assuming you can have a complete set of preferences. So how do you handle that? You ignore as many of those combinations as you possibly can. Rational behaviour isn't choosing the best combination for yourself out of the 390,000. It's ignoring as many of the 390,000 as you can do and still make a reasonable choice. It's the exact opposite of what conventional theory says is rational behaviour. Now, that's not irrational at all, because the array of choices you face just walking through your normal day-to-day life is so overwhelming that if you tried to make the best choice every time, you'd starve to death. Think about Subway. Go down and check out Subway. How many different types of bread there are? 5 types of bread? Okay. How many different meats? About 10. How many different vegetables? About 5 or 6. You put all the combinations together. Do you have it with cheese with that or not cheese? Toasted or not toasted, etc., etc. If you go through it, you'll probably find yourself getting about 1 million combinations. Like, that'd be fun. I'd like to find somebody doing the calculations for me. How many combinations could you actually make of Subway, down at the local Subway? You'd be probably cracking the million, I imagine. So the difficulty isn't in choosing the best option, it's in making a satisfactory choice in a finite time. Let's look at shopping now, realistically. Let's say there's 100 items at a corner store. It's not going to, a supermarket doesn't have 100 items, there's a lot more than 100. A good supermarket will have 10,000 different items inside it, and probably in about close to 1,000 different product categories. Let's say you've got 100 there, and you're simply going to make a decision whether you do or do not buy one unit of each item in the shop. So you're going to walk out with either 0 or 1 unit of everything inside the supermarket or corner shop. How many combinations? It's 2 raised to the power of 100. That's the number. Now, I had to sit down for a while and work out what that was verbally. It's 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 different combinations. I think that's probably more combinations of commodities in the corner shop than there are stars in the universe. Again, somebody could check it up for Google for me and find out. That'd be intriguing to find out. That's how complex the simple act of going shopping is. Imagine that many shopping trolleys. I think we're talking enough shopping trolleys to cause a black hole. So the model you've been taught is a toy model. If it looks good on paper, it's enough to fool people who don't actually try to apply it seriously, but it can't possibly scale to reality. And I don't mean the reality of the modern society we live in, I mean the reality of your corner shop, which is pretty simple as parts of the world go. And that is because consumption fits into what computer programmers call a problem of exponential complexity. And that is that each time you add an extra choice to make, you raise by a power the number of choices there are. And that becomes impossible for anybody or anything to ever compute. And it's a problem of 2 to the n. To buy or not buy means you've got 2 choices, either 0 or 1 unit of every item. And there's n combinations for n commodities, so you get 2 to the n coming out of that. And 2 to the n gets to be a very big number. Have you heard the story about the philosopher who solved some problem for a king, some ancient king? And the king said, "What reward do you want?" And the philosopher said, "I'm a humble man, sire. All I would want is you to put 1 grain of rice on 1 square of a chessboard, and then 2 on the next, and 4, and then 8. And the king thought that was a really good deal until he killed the guy, because he realized to give him that much wheat, he'd have to hand over his entire kingdom and several neighboring kingdoms. That's the problem of exponential complexity. So if you actually tried doing this with a computer, the computer would necessarily fail. Let's just imagine we've got a computer that's so powerful, it can calculate the utility of any given bundle in 1/10,000,000th of a second. Pretty fast. Then how long would it take you to work out the optimal combination, whether you just do or do not buy, with 50 commodities? That's the calculation on the chart there. It'd take you 3.5 years to go shopping in the corner shop. Okay? You'd starve to death before you fed yourself. That's not rational. The definition you've been taught is an irrational definition. And you can't make it any better by saying, well, maybe the human brain is much more powerful than a computer. Because we have lots and lots of neurons in our brain. We have 10 to the 11 neurons. or 100 billion neurons. That's, so I think that's slightly less brain cells than there are stars in the Milky Way. Lots of brain cells there. Now, each of those connects to 1,000 others. Your intelligence, we believe, comes out of the pattern of connections you make between one set of neurons and the other, and how they fire and weight things. And signalling between neurons, which involves chemical processes within a neuron and then a transfer of chemicals of what's called the synapse, they're all physical processes that take a certain amount of time. And they're transmitted by voltage spikes, potassium. A potassium ion goes along, travels along through an axon to pass the message to you. The synapse involves some other chemical process I've forgotten. But the neuron takes about 1 millisecond, 1,000th of a second to generate a spike. And that's like transferring the data along that one neuron out of the 100 billion inside your brain. Now, to actually make a decision, it might take 100 steps like that. And then, of course, many signals from many neurons are required to actually make a decision. So, to try to get some sort of handle on it, it tends to take between 50 and 100 milliseconds to make a decision of recognition. If you're driving the car, and you suddenly notice there's a car coming out on the left-hand side before it's going to hit you, it takes between 1/20th and 1/10th of a second for you to notice that. Okay? That's the sort of time level we're talking about. So to make 100 perceptions like that would take about 5 seconds. So if your brain actually worked as in a massively parallel calculator of revealed preference, which it doesn't, and if every decision took 5 seconds, then your brain would operate at 5 by 10 to the minus 11 decisions per second, faster than the computer I showed you beforehand. Does that solve the problem? Unfortunately not. It would then take you, rather than 3.5 years, it would merely take you 40 minutes to go shopping at the corner shop. Now, if I sent somebody out to the corner shop to get stuff from me and they took 40 minutes to come back, I'd think they were lost. Okay. If you don't take 40 minutes, if you spend 40 minutes in a corner shop, they think you're shoplifting. Okay. So, this is not a solution. The more processing power you throw at it is easily overwhelmed by making the decision more complicated. So if you get to the stage of, say, 100 decisions, you get to the stage where the number of years it would take you to make that decision scales to 80,000 million years, or roughly 6 times the age of the universe. You simply can't solve this problem by throwing more processing power at it. The number of calculations, the number of comparisons you make scales exponentially each time you add an additional commodity to it, and you get a ridiculous number of comparisons to make just to go to the corner shop. 10 million, billion different combinations. And they're non-computable. The thing that computer scientists have learned, and one reason I do recommend if you actually want to go on in economics, study something else as well as economics. Do computing, do some mathematics, do biology, anything. To take you outside the mindset of an economist, because you learn a lot you can apply within economics, and it's why I've managed to make some of the advances I've made by learning things like computer programming. So I know these things from having been taught in the literature. So it's simply impossible for a computer program to solve that problem. So what the computer program will do instead, if you actually got a programmer to do it for you, would be to find a way to minimize the number of choices as much as possible while still making a satisfactory conclusion. And the only problems you can actually say, give me exactly the right answer, are ones that are conform to what they call polynomial as opposed to exponential time. And I'll give you an example of one here called a bubble sort algorithm. And the idea here is you've got a list of numbers, you want to sort them. It's like you let the number at the bottom bubble up to the top until the numbers above it are all smaller than it is. Then it stops bubbling. And then you bubble the next one up. That's why it's called a bubble sort algorithm. So you select the very last value in a table. You've got a random set of numbers, you choose the last one. You then choose the next to last and another randomly chose number. So you're going to flip those two numbers around. If either of those is larger than the pivot, then you swap the place. Okay? Because you've got the one at the bottom, the one above it, and some other one randomly up. If either of those two above it are bigger, you swap the place with the one down the bottom, so the one at the bottom bubbles up as time goes on. You move the smaller one to where the larger one was, and you keep on repeating that all the way through until everything above it is smaller, and then you break the list into two groups, and you do the same thing within the subgroups. So that's what it looks like. This is an example here of a bubble sort. You start with the numbers 3, 7, 8, 5, 2, 1, 9, 5, and 4, and then you do that comparison between 5 and randomly shows up at the top, which is 7. And 4 is smaller than both those numbers, so you bubble it up and move the bigger of the two, which is 7, down into the place that 4 occupied beforehand. And then you keep on doing the same process. Now that ends up being about 30 operations. And after 30 operations, you've sorted it properly. The worst possible thing is if you actually got the numbers in reverse order, then it'd take you n squared, which is 100 operations, to do the same thing. But you'd ultimately do it. Now if you had 1,000 numbers, it'd take you 1,000,000 steps. If you had 1,000,000 numbers, it'd take you 1,000,000,000,000 steps. That's a large number, but it's still, you know, about the size of the memory on your computers. It's not an impossible number. So you can do a polynomial function. You can get exactly the right answer for a polynomial problem. And ultimately, one of the rules is that on the average, it'll take, if n is the number of things you have to process, it'll take n multiplied by the log of n on average to do that. So there's 1,000 numbers, it's 1,000 times the log of that, which is 3, so it'll take you 3,000 steps. That sort of idea. Now, there were 34 in the example I showed you beforehand. That's doable stuff. But given the fact that most things in economics are actually not polynomial time problems, but exponential time problems, you simply can't do it. So here's a comparison of the number of choices to look at and how long it would take you to do it. Adding up n numbers, you've got to do n operations. The more numbers you add, it's just one more number to add to the list. Okay? To sort numbers, you've got that n squared problem. To work out utility, you've got 2 to the power of n, which becomes a ridiculous number. To look at buying 0, 1, 2, or 3, it's 4 to the power of n. Again, a ridiculous number. If you could do 1,000,000,000 comparisons a second, then to do a typical shopping trip would take longer than the age of the universe multiplied by the age of the universe. It simply isn't possible to be rational, as economists define rational. So the whole definition is back to front. It falls over at the very first step. So this is the argument. Completeness, reality, is your capacity to compare just collapses very rapidly. You can't compare all the bundles. It's out the window. Transitivity, non-satiation, and convexity all fall over because if you can't have completeness, you can't work out the other three. Now, interestingly enough, the guy who gave us the theory of... gave at the beginning of the theory of finance was a mathematician and computer programmer called John von Neumann. And he didn't like indifference curves at all. He was actually trying to get rid of them. I'll tell you about that in the fourth lecture. And in talking about these axioms, the one he expected and he expressed any reservations about was completeness. He didn't carry on with it, but he thought, I can lay out the base. Completeness looks a bit strange. I haven't thought enough about that. But he didn't like the whole idea of indifference curves anyway. He was trying to get rid of them using his ideas and expected utility. But then back to this again. We still managed to shop. So what on earth are we doing? A guy called Herbert Simon invented the term satisficing. And that proposition is, he was another Nobel Prize winner, by the way, and in my opinion, one of the ones who deserved the Nobel Prize, unlike people like Samuelson, who led us up a garden path. But satisficing says you try to make a reasonable set of decision in finite time. And you also set priorities. When you go shopping, you make sure you come home with milk and bread. Okay? There's some things you have to buy. And you have habit. If you've always eaten cornflakes, you normally buy cornflakes each time you go. If you've normally bought muesli, you normally buy muesli. So habit makes it easy to walk inside, I'll take that, that, and that, and walk out the other door. And in fact, if you think about what marketing is trying to do, it's trying to say, we know this is what you normally do, why not try this one this time? Okay? Move the habit slightly. That's why marketing is necessary. Whereas conventional economic theory says marketing is unnecessary because you already know your preferences. That's nonsense. And you categorise. You buy from particular commodities. So you go and you buy fruit. And what you buy in the fruit category might be influenced by the price. So if today it happens to be that strawberries are cheap, you might buy more strawberries than you'd normally do. But you still could spend much the same amount of money overall on fruit as you'd normally do. Okay? So priorities. And each time you do that, you're reducing the dimensionality. If you go into a supermarket and think there's 2,000 commodities there, I'm going to choose the utility maximising combination of the 2,000, as I show you, you'll starve to death before you make it to the till. But if you say, I want meat, vegetables, dairy, and fish, and some tissues, you've reduced the number of dimensions from thousands to five. And it's possible to make a sensible decision. And that's a large part of what rational behaviour is reducing the dimensionality of an extremely complex problem. So this is one of the ways in which people in computer science have thought about this, and they've said they've actually got their own laws. And what I've shown you, by the way, straight away, back to the law of demand, is that one essential component of what economists call the law is impossible in reality. Now, most times when a science talks about a law, they're talking about something that cannot be violated by reality. So the standard that a scientist applies to what they call law is far higher than what economists do, because they actually test it. They work out what happens. One of the most important laws in science is called the second law of thermodynamics. And if anybody doesn't assume that in modelling how an engine behaves, they'll make an engine which fails, or they'll fail the exam over the question. And it's been confirmed in 100% of cases, we've confirmed the second law of thermodynamics. In this particular case, in one out of 11 cases, Sybil managed to get somebody who looked like they were rational according to the theory. Now, on this particular case, there are laws of computer programming which talk about complexity. And they say there are two areas where they say these laws apply. Computability and complexity. Now, they're going to look very paradoxical when you see them, but I think you might understand the paradox now, having taken you through the shopping trip. First law is you cannot compute nearly all those things you want to compute. In other words, most problems don't have an exact solution. And there's a whole range of mathematical theorems about that, Gödel and Turing proofs, the various proofs of that nature. The second thing, once you choose the things you can prove, they're too expensive to prove. In other words, again, like I've shown you a moment ago, to try to choose a utility-maximising bundle just can't be done. There's no computer big enough, there's no brain large enough, there's no universe old enough for that to be done in. So you can't get exact answers to everything. And a large part of computer programming is getting the best answer you can in a finite time. So goodbye revealed preference. You can't use indifference curves and budget lines to characterise how individuals behave. And normal behaviour must violate those axioms. It isn't a case that it's optional to violate them. If you're going to survive as a human being, you have to break those so-called axioms. So rational behaviour for real consumers in the real world is making a satisfactory decision in a finite amount of time by minimising the number of choices you need to make. So right at the very outset, the theory you've been taught in micro so far fails to define a rational individual. And it gets worse, because in the next lecture, I'm going to forget about that for a while and assume that it actually does work and you can actually derive an individual's demand curve using that theory. And I'm then going to show that even if you could do that, you can't derive a market demand curve that looks like any of the market demand curves you've seen drawn in your textbooks. That's also false. So, we'll get into that next week. And thanks a lot. We'll take it from there.